Hi everyone. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that George Bright, who is Patricia's guest on this episode, will be teaching an in-person seminar on May 17th at the Sheraton Suites close to O'Hare. We will be recording the seminar and making it available at a later date for those who are not able to attend. But if you are able to attend, please click on the link in the show notes for more information or visit our website, youngchicago.org. Thanks.
Joining us today is George Bright. George Bright is a scholar on Carl Jung's Red Book, Liber Novus. Bright was educated at Cambridge University and the London School of Economics. He's a training and supervising analyst of the Society of Analytical Psychology, and he is a co-founder of the Circle of Analytical Psychology, a London-based group which provides two-year courses in the study of Carl Jung's Liber Novus and the Black Books. He has worked in private practice in London for the past 35 years. George Bright, welcome to Jung in the World.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about Jung's Red Book.
Thank you. So I want to begin with the most basic question. The title. Why the Red Book for people who are new to it?
Well, the answer to that is very simple, but there is a little slightly more complicated footnote to it. The simple answer is it's called the Red Book because when Jung decided to record the experiences that he'd been having from 1913 onwards, he bought an expensively produced leather-bound book, and the cover was red. That's the simple answer. But the slightly more complicated answer is, in the Red Book, Jung not only recorded his experiences and his thoughts, which he did in calligraphic script, in other words, in a medieval script, but he also illustrated what he had to put in the book with hundreds of images, all of them in great detail and some of them very small. And the color coding in these images is quite complex, but red is one of the key colors. And red usually refers to the human, to life, to blood. So I think the Red Book also just possibly has a hint of a book that's to do with humanity. Now, I said there was a slightly complicated footnote to the simple answer, which is that in the facsimile edition of the Red Book, which was published in 2009, which is effectively a high-quality photocopy of the original, on the cover of that, it's marked Jung's Red Book, Liber Novus. Liber Novus being the two Latin words that are on the spine of Jung's original edition, literally the new book. Jung didn't finish transcribing his text of Liber Novus, the new book, into the Red Book. He broke off about two-thirds of the way through, and for reasons that we might discuss later. But I think it's worth mentioning that when I refer to the Red Book, I'm referring specifically to the calligraphic volume. In other words, to not only the text, but the images. Yes, the one that's behind you and the one that people will have if they've got the large full facsimile volume. But if I say Liber Novus, I'm referring not just to that, but to the whole of the text which Jung wrote, the text which he only transcribed about the first half to two-thirds into the Red Book. So if I say Liber Novus, I mean the whole text. And if I say the Red Book, I'm referring specifically to the calligraphic volume with its images as well as words.
So, yeah, and yes, it's like an illuminated manuscript, you know?
And in fact, the first 12 pages, like an illuminated manuscript, are not actually even written in the book. They're written on sheets of parchment. After the first 12 pages, which comprise part one of what's essentially a three-part work, the first 12 pages cover book one. And maybe Jung stopped using parchment because the painting materials were bleeding through slightly from one side to the other. But I think it's also quite possible that Jung quite deliberately used parchment for the first book, because that is, as it were, the core of the work. I mean, as you probably know, parchment lasts vastly longer than paper.
Yes, he created this to endure.
I think particularly book one.
Yes. It's an interesting choice, isn't it? And there's also something very visceral. I have not ever used parchment, but people who do use it to create very custom artistic manuscripts will use it partially because there's an interaction between the hand, the pen, the mind, and the parchment that is unique. Do you know anything about that? Or I know I'm getting a little precious here, but it does make me curious.
I think that's important. I think there is an aesthetic to the production of it. I mean, Jung told one of his patients, who he was encouraging to put her thoughts down in a similar kind of way, told her that it was like building a cathedral for yourself into which you could go at any point to meditate. And I think that's what Jung probably did with his own Red Book. You know, I think that later on in his life, he went into it to meditate.
I want to start with the origin, you know. Jungians love a good creation story. And I think back on the moment in 1913, Carl Jung is on a train. He has concluded that knowing all that he does now about the psyche and the importance of the unconscious, that he can no longer, and he uses the word honestly, continue psychotherapy and analysis using Freud's theories. He must create something of his own as a system. And I want you to talk about from that moment and take us through to the Red Book and its inception.
Right. I think the first thing that one has to do with this is to clear away some of the undergrowth that's grown up over the first 100 years of psychoanalysis, let's say. The undergrowth that grew really because there was very little historical information. I mean, at the time that I trained as an analyst, pretty much everything about Freud and Jung was written by other analysts. In the last 20 years, there's been a huge development of proper historical research into the origins of the psychoanalytic movement and of analytical psychology. And this has transformed the landscape. And what you've just described is part of the undergrowth that grew up in the absence of an adequate degree of historical knowledge and research. I mean, part of this undergrowth was created by Jung and by Freud. You know, Freud's History of the Psychoanalytic Movement, written after Jung resigned in 1913, it's not a history in the contemporary sense. It's a kind of foundation document of a myth. And Jung, similarly, was very fond of a good story. and well able to put things in a way that were not actually historically accurate. So I think rather than the image of Jung realizing that he could no longer in conscience subscribe to Freud's theories, one has to go back a little bit and see what was happening in 1910, 11, 12. Sonia Chandasani, the editor of the Red Book, and I suppose the most important living Jung historian, talks about the Freudocentric mislocation of Jung's work. In other words, to see Jung's work as essentially an offshoot from Freud. And he's pointed out with, a substantial argument behind it, that Jung's association with Freud lasted for less than 7 years. Jung, when he came in 1925 to describe the roots of his own ideas, said quite clearly that they had little to do with Freud. They came from other sources, Flournoy, Janet. Freud and Jung had an association which, to my mind, was largely to the benefit of Freud rather than of Jung, in the sense that it gave Freud's very small psychoanalytic movement access to one of the big university teaching hospitals, the Burgholzli, which is where Jung worked. Jung and Bleuler, who was the medical director of the Burgholzli, both signed up to the psychoanalytic movement, which one has to remember at that time was only about 40 or 50 people.
I think this is a good point. I believe that people don't today fully understand just what a frontier this was.
I mean, the main pioneering work of Jung at this stage was, of course, the word association test, which was a piece of number-crunching scientific psychology, measuring things with chronometers and so forth.
So when he was at the teaching hospital, that's where we left off. Bring us back.
Yes. So by about 1911, Bleuler was getting very tired of Freud's authoritarian attitude, and Bleuler backed out of the psychoanalytic group. He said that it wasn't possible for him as a scientist to be associated with something where the touchstone of truth was whether Freud said it was true or not. And that was quite clearly Freud said that he was the authority on what was or wasn't psychoanalysis, and that Freud was the authority on essentially what was true and what wasn't. And I think Jung was also very uncomfortable about that. And it was essentially, I think, on the issue of Freud's authority to say what was and wasn't true, that Jung also backed away from the psychoanalytic movement. The myth is that when Jung wrote Symbols and Transformations of the Libido, which was published in the International Psychoanalytic Yearbook in 1912, that when he wrote that, he was reintroducing a category of religion, which he wasn't. That belongs to the revised edition of that work, which Jung published in 1952. As he said to Father Victor White in the 50s, at the beginning of my career, I repudiated everything that smelled of belief. That accounts for my attitude in the psychology of the unconscious, which was the English title of that book. So they didn't split up over religion, nor did they split up, I think, because there was a big clash of personalities, as has sometimes been described. I think they split up quite simply over the question of authority. So I'm not sure that Jung was dissociating himself from Freud's ideas, because I'm not sure that Freud's ideas had played that large a part in Jung's practice at that stage. I mean, if you look at what Jung was actually doing at that stage, besides working as a psychiatrist, you know, writing forensic reports for courts and so forth, he was doing things like the word association experiments and using the word association tests. He was doing a certain amount of what would certainly look like Freudian psychoanalysis. But bear in mind, it was at a very, very early stage. I mean, Freud's papers on technique, which more or less define how to do psychoanalysis, weren't published until 1913. So that's the roughly what I wanted to clear out of the way. Maybe the other thing just to comment on is the idea that Freud and Jung was deeply upset by the breach with Freud, and then, you know, the myth that we've had around for years that he more or less went mad for a couple of years with loneliness and anxiety as a result of the breach. I think that's plainly not true. I mean, reading the historical documents, if anything, the breach with Freud was an independence celebration for independence of thought and attitude.
That's interesting to me.
Can I just say one more thing, which may be a little relevant to this, but I think, if anything, the person who was really upset was Freud. You know, I think there's far more evidence that Freud was hurt and never really got over it. Sometime in the 1940s, Eddie Bennett, who was one of Jung's early followers in London, asked Jung if it wouldn't be, this is the late 30s, if it wouldn't be diplomatic to ask Freud, who had just arrived in London, to something. And Jung wrote to Bennett and said, I think it would be very cruel because Freud is still wounded from the separation, and it wouldn't be kind to rub salt into an old man's wounds.
Very interesting. So I'm thinking about Plato's belief that the soul seeks knowledge of itself. And it's interesting to me that Carl Jung not only sought knowledge of his soul, but actual engagement with it. And I'm curious, you being a psychoanalyst yourself, do you advise people to write and engage creatively in the same way that Carl Jung did in the Red Book, to have conversations with our souls? And how difficult is that to do?
I mean, I think it's interesting that the short answer to your question is no, I don't. The slightly longer answer is, if Jung in several places talks about active imagination as something that anybody can train themselves to do, that any of us can train ourselves to have these kinds of dialogues. In my experience, that is not true. A few people do, but most, including me, don't, at least not in anything like the way that Jung did. Now, I rather think if Jung had really wanted to, he could have written a book on the practice of active imagination, or at any rate a substantial paper, and he didn't. The only one that mentions it in any detail is something that was only published in the 50s, his essay, The Transcendent Function. I can say quite a lot about the various ways in which I think dialogues with other energies and forces do happen in analysis, but it's not, in my experience, in the way that it happened for Jung.
I, not being a scholar on the Red Book and not being an analyst, just being a passionate, curious, interested person in the ideas of Carl Jung, I have to say that for me, the Red Book reads like a quest. He's journeying into something. Is that accurate?
I think quest puts it, yes. I mean, Jung is a person of unlimited curiosity. I think Quest is pushing it slightly too much like a heroic journey, which it quite clearly wasn't. One of the first active imaginations that Jung has in the autumn of 13 is the murder of the hero Siegfried. And writing the layer two material about that, he says that it was effectively the murder of his intellectual curiosity, really taking up his soul's point that he's not feeding his vanity to write another book. I think rather than a quest, I would say he was driven. I think he got into it because he had to. At an early stage, he writes in the Black Books, this is an entry that doesn't make it into the Red Book text, why am I chained to this book? I don't think he was a particularly willing subject, and I certainly don't think he was on a mission. Afterwards, he was on a mission, certainly. Once he had had what he regarded as revelatory visionary material, he was on a mission for the rest of his life as to how to put it out there, something which concerned him greatly and a problem that he feared he hadn't properly solved.
But he is experimenting.
Oh, yes.
And it calls to mind the American inventor Buckminster Fuller saying, I'm the only guinea pig I have.
Well, that's true. And I mean, remember that at that stage, pretty much everybody in the psychology psychiatry field was experimenting on themselves. I mean, you know, self-experiment was a very, very popular way of trying to develop knowledge. And Jung was most certainly one of the self-experimenters, as was Freud, as was William James.
Yes. And, you know, there's a line in the Red Book, elaborating what had burst forth from the unconscious and flooded me like an enigmatic stream and threatened to break me. That line has a great, it's a half a sentence, really. It has a great deal of energy to it.
Yes, it does. I mean, the whole text is highly energetic. I mean, some of it is spine-tinglingly exciting and frightening to read.
Well, and there are some scholars who say, really, in that regard, the Red Book is a vessel bound by two, you know, bound by its cover. It's a vessel of energies. What do you think of that?
One of the people in a seminar that I co-lead to read the Red Book described it a little while ago as psychoactive material. And I think he's right.
Say more about that.
Well, my first introduction to the Red Book, it was a very privileged one. Professor Shamdasani ran a small seminar for analysts that ran for about 10 or 12 years in London to read the Red Book. And he, as an historian and as the editor, introduced it to us. And I went to this, and after about a year, I began to realize that this was not just an academic seminar for me, that something was happening, that this was more like some sort of transformative initiatory process that was going on, which I hadn't particularly sought, and I certainly hadn't expected. This was far more than just being gripped by a new subject. It was turning things upside down in ways that I hadn't expected, and which, if anything, reminded me of what had happened to me in the periods of my own analysis beforehand. I mean, it's that kind of experience.
So that it didn't threaten to break you, but it did break you open.
Oh, it broke me open, and it broke a lot of what was. I mean, transformation, as Jung sort of points out in many places, is not a particularly benign experience.
I think that's part of the value of reading Carl Jung. It's about shadow and
in the Red Book about evil.
Yes,
I mean the main at the points at which things become stuck in the Red Book story, the person who unsticks it is Satan.
Yes. Can we go into that just a little bit? Because it's almost a moment of crisis, you know, in the arc of the drama of the book. It is a moment.
I think it's really important as one of the main thrusts of Lyginovas is that a new god has been born, that we are in a new age, and the new age is marked by the coming to birth of a new god. Now, when Jung comes to try to write up pretty much the whole of the program of the Red Book in conceptual scientific psychological terms, in psychological types, in 1921, he paraphrases the birth of a new god as the birth of a new highest value. And the new highest value, or the new highest god, whichever you like, of the Red Book, is a god or a value that unites the Christian God and Satan. In other words, the new God, which is the God of new life, is not the Christian God of goodness and love. It's the God of the whole of life, the nasty bits as well as the nice bits. And I think this is possibly the most important point of the whole work. The aim now is not goodness. The aim now is the living of life. And that means not just suppressing evil so as to be good, which was the Christian program, but living evil as well as good.
How difficult is it to live that way?
Well, I mean, near impossible. But Jung's view is that we have no choice. Eric Neumann, one of Jung's followers, wrote a book called Analytical Psychology and the New Ethic. And he sent the manuscript to Jung for Jung's comments. And we can read those now because they've been published in the Jung-Neumann correspondence that Princeton have published. And at one point, Neumann says something about integrating evil. And Jung puts a line against this and says, you cannot integrate evil. He said, all you can do with evil is moral choice and ritual action. I mean, the thrust of the Red Book is that the gods, which Jung later calls archetypes, inhabit and possess the human subject because we, the human, are the only moral agency in the cosmos. It is only us, humans, that can distinguish between good and evil. The gods can't, the archetypes can't, they are just energy, power. They inhabit us, and we have to do the hard work of moral choice.
I could see where some Christians, in that reading it in that time, would think, well, it didn't get published in 2009, but that idea in those times had to seem blasphemous because God is perceived as an energy of goodness.
I mean, in the Christian, the whole Jewish, Christian, Islamic tradition, love is at the heart of the Godhead. God is love. As I read it, in Jung's Lyginovas new book, love is a property of the human. At one point, Jung catches his soul trying to steal love from him. And she says that she longs for it because she hasn't got it. She longs for love, warm human love, warm red blood. It's only the human who can love, in Jung's view. The gods can't. The gods need us to do it for them.
And what of moral choice?
Well, the moral choice is what we have to do. I mean, the point at which I think nearly everybody comes to analysis is when they have a dilemma, which is usually a moral dilemma, which they simply cannot solve. And I mean a true dilemma, you know, on the one hand, on the other. And you can't hack off one side of it, nor can you resolve the two sides of, you know, a total paradox. That's it's usually the point of moral dilemma that brings people to analysis. I mean, you know, just take a stereotypical example. You know, happily married person with a family finds she has fallen head over heels in love with somebody else. Unable to deny the reality of the love and its power, unable to deny the reality of the love for the family and spouse. I mean, a not uncommon situation, to say the least. I mean, it's that kind of dilemma where there is no possibility of human resolution that I think is nearly always the starting point of somebody seeking analytic help. I think because there's some idea in somewhere in the atmosphere that analysts won't try to persuade you to make a choice, that analysts will allow you, give you some latitude for finding a way of making it yourself. And I think that's essentially what Jung's talking about when he's talking about the new God being the God of the whole of life.
And so to make a moral choice, such as the one that you use as an example, getting to a resolution is its own transformation.
Exactly. There's a very clear section in book two of Liber Novus called The Way of the Cross. And I'll just describe that briefly because I think it gives a little insight into how to read this work and what it's about. So the act of imagination is very simple. In the act of imagination, Jung sees the figure of the crucified, the Christ, dead on the cross, and a snake, a black snake, crawls into the body of the crucified and comes out through the crucified's mouth, forms a diadem around the crucified's head, and then the sun rises. And that's all the act of imagination is. Now, when he comments about this 6 months later, writing in early 1915 in the Layer 2, the way, by this time, has become Jung's coded word for the individuation process. So the way of the cross is when your life process meets with death. And he begins the Layer 2 by saying, when the way enters death. In other words, when what you can do hits the buffers, you know, can no longer move forward. And when the way enters death, he says, it is at this point that the new God might arise. And he says, if the new God does arise, the first thing that one has to avoid is to kill the new God off, because the first instinct is to kill it, to render it powerless with understanding, for example. But he says, if you don't murder the new God, then very quickly the new God will rise and become your charioteer. In other words, begin to run your life. Now, this is what I think I've seen happen innumerable times in analysis, and which has probably happened to me too, which is that, you know, when one is at one's wit's end, if one can maintain what Jung was calling ritual action to Neumann, like the ritual of going to analysis several times a week, or whatever other containing rituals one has, then something new can arise. And if something does arise, and you allow it to take over, then you are in a transformed situation. It doesn't mean it's any easier. It doesn't mean there isn't suffering. It doesn't mean that you may not have to do a deal with evil. But you are in a new situation. It's as if a new sun has risen.
Well, I feel called to exercise the ritual action of this podcast, which is to thank my guest. Thank you for all that you shared with our audience about the Red Book and about Carl Jung. And we could probably talk for another hour or do several podcasts with you, because your wisdom and just what you know is so helpful in guiding someone through this work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information about training programs, live and self-study courses, archives, this podcast, our blog, or to find Jungian analysts near you, visit our website, jungchicago.org. Thank you to our 2023 donors who gave at the contributor level or above: Barbara Anand, Yuni Alka, April Barrett, Arlo Compan, Judith Cooper, Lorna Crowell, David Dalrymple, Kevin Davis, Dr. Peter DeMuth, Mary Doherty, Christine Foskett, Britta W. Jacobson, Mary Ann Johnson, Mary W. Liebman, Mona Manning, Patricia Martin, Boris Matthews, Kenan McKee, Sue Rosenthal, David O. Stess, Lawrence C. Tingley, Don Troyer, Robert Ulrich, Alexander Wayne and Lynn Cobb, Gerald Weiner, William Wolfe, and Ellen Young. You can support this podcast by making a donation at our website, jungchicago.org.